Thank you, John, for the invitation to give this talk. I'm very happy to report on our recent work on the all topics of bosonization of Fermi liquid. You will see that there is a new, we applied new method called the method of Kowarcza in orbit that seems to be useful in this problem. The plan of my talk will be as follows. So first I will review the Landau's Fermi liquid theory almost in the original form that it was proposed. And then I try to emphasize for you that the theory of Landau Fermi liquid can be thought of as a theory that governs the dynamics of shapes. In this case, the shape of the Fermi surface that fluctuates when we excite the Fermi liquid at long distances. And that these dynamics of shapes is a very natural place where one can apply a method in mathematics, the method of Kowarcza in orbit. So I'm going to give you a bit of a mathematical introduction to the method of Kowarcza in orbit and then explain why it's useful for Fermi liquid in particular. Here we are dealing with the Kowarcza in orbit of the group of canonical transformation that allows us to reformulate the Landau Fermi liquid theory as a field theory. The reference of this talk is our preprint posted in March, and my collaborator in this work are Luca de la Cretas, who is a postdoc in Chicago, and two of my students, Yixian Lu and Umang Mehta. If there is any question during the talk, please interrupt me at any time. So Fermi liquid theory has a long history. It was suggested first by Landau in this paper in 1956-1957. And the idea of Landau is the following, is that if we consider a system of interacting fermions, the low energy dynamics of this system is almost like the dynamics of a non-interacting fermionic system. So I copied here a paragraph in his paper, and this is a very well-known explanation of why the dynamics of even an interacting fermionic system is simple. And that is because what Landau called here the diffuse at finite temperature, the diffuse, what he called the diffuse Fermi zone, that is the region where the modes are excited at finite temperature, shrinks inside where the temperature goes to zero. So if we take the system at lower and lower temperature, then one can think about it using a certain order of magnitude estimate. We can argue that this can be thought of as the Fermi liquid can be thought of as a system consisting of quasi particles that are long lived. The lifetime of this quasi particle goes to infinity faster than the inverse of its energy. So these quasi particles become more and more well defined as we approach the Fermi surface. Sometimes the Fermi liquid is described as a free Fermi gas of Landau quasi-particle, and this is only partially correct. It's not completely true. In Landau Fermi liquid theory, as I will explain, there is a very well-defined structure of interaction between the Landau's quasi-particles that have to be taken into account if we want to do the quantitative calculations of correlation function. So it is instructive to first describe the structure of Landau's Fermi liquid theory as originally sketched by Landau and described in standard textbook like in Landau-Lifshitz or in Abrikosov, Gorkov, Zaloshinsky. So let's first talk about free fermions. The free fermions, a system of free fermions, can be described by a phase space distribution function. So here F, occupation number is a function of time, space, and momentum. And in an external electromagnetic field, the distribution function, this distribution function obeys dynamical equations of this form called the Liouville's equation. So here we have to specify the regime of validity of these equations. It is valid whenever our perturbations varies at frequency omega that is much less than the Fermi energy. Here I put h bar equal to 1 all the time. And the momentum or the wave number of the perturbation has to be less than the Fermi momentum. In particular, our fields, the electric field and the magnetic fields have to vary over wavelengths larger than 1 over km. Then one can derive this Liouville's equation, which described, in some sense, this Liouville's equation described the response of a free Fermi gas on external perturbation. And there are various ways to one can derive this equation. Moreover, if you look at this equation, it's basically it's a kinetic equation. We followed like a swarm of particles, a given point in momentum space, how it evolved in the phase space. I'm sorry, the swarm of particles in phase space, and we see that this particle move in phase space along the x direction with the velocity v, along the momentum direction with the velocity proportional to the force acting on the particle. And the one feature of this evolution is that it would preserve phase space volume. And so if the initial condition on the function f is such that there is a sharp Fermi surface that separates a region where the occupation number is 1 from a region where the occupation number is 0, then this shape, this sharp surface separating the two regions, this structure of the wave function, of the occupation number, is preserved under time evolution. So when we evolve this function f using the Liouville's equation, it will remain either 0 or 1. Only the surface that separates the region of f equal to 1 changes with time. So this means that this Liouville equation can be thought of as an equation that describes the dynamics of shapes of the Fermi surface in phase space. So in other words, let me draw some kind of picture. If I have a shape like this, it's a initial, if I set up an initial condition in which the occupation number of my particle. So here I'm concentrating my attention on two-dimensional fermions. So here I assume f equal to 1, and here f equal to 0. You have to think about this picture as occurring in every point in space. So the shape of the Fermi surface can also depend on the spatial coordinate x. So at a given x, the shape of the Fermi surface is like this. At a different x, it might be different. But if I start from this initial condition, using the Boltzmann equation, I will be able to evolve that, and this shape will change with time. So at some another time, the shape might be like this. So the only thing that we know is that this, for sure, is that the shape changes, the total number of particles is preserved. And so the integral of the volume of this Fermi region over space is preserved. So from this, yeah.
When should we consider fermions in momentum space, and when should we consider them in free space? Strictly speaking, the uncertainty principle should forbid a simultaneous definite X and P.
Yeah, but here what saves us is that we are dealing with the dynamics of a system at long distances, so we can this function f that we have here varies along over a very long distance. So we can, for example, think about a beam, right? This beam can have a size that is delta x that is much larger than 1/kf. So that means that spontaneously we can say that we have some particle inside the beam, and the accuracy of the determination of the momentum is still much less than the Fermi momentum. So yes, we have certain uncertainty in defining X and P simultaneously, but if we are dealing with the physics in a long wavelength regime, then practically we can talk about quasi-particle at a given X and P.
Uh-huh. And this is already guaranteed under the condition Q much less than Kf.
Yeah, so the kinetic equation doesn't make sense if we want to think about Q of order Kf. You have to do better than this Liouville equation.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, so now this theory give us a way to calculate.
Just to make sure, then in the previous slide, what's the rule of omega much smaller than epsilon f play? There's no interaction here.
Yeah, that's required. Maybe I have to think a little bit more about this, but maybe in some cases this condition can be relaxed, but just for sure, let me set omega much less than f. And then I one simplification I get from there is that if I excite a particle hole pair, they are all near the Fermi surface, so I don't have to think about a region where my quasi particle are far away from the Fermi surface.
But in the without any interaction, does it really matter too much?
I think it matter, yeah. But let me think about this a bit.
Sure. Thanks.
Yeah, it makes at least it makes one simplification, is that we don't have to think about the excitation far away from. Yeah, I understand what you're saying. In the presence of interaction, it's going to be important. Not sure about this case of free fermion.
Thanks.
Yeah. And so the really a correlation function can be obtained by solving the equations, the Liouville equation. For example, we want to determine the linear response of the theory to the response of our system to external electric field. We have to linearize the equations. This is the linearized Liouville equation here, and then solve it. And we solve it. We find delta f as a function of delta f is going to be something proportional to external E. And from that, putting into the expression for the density, density is basically integral of delta f, delta rho as a function of x is integral of delta f as a function of x in p over p. Then we get the response function. For example, the density-density correlation function is given in this formula that I write here. And this is a formula exactly the same as one would obtain, for example, by the Feynman diagram in the low omega and low Q system. Nonlinear response can also obtain in the regime of validity of the Liouville's equation. We can compute the response of a system to quadratic order in E by solving the Liouville's equation to one order more than what we did here by iteration, for example. Okay, so now let's talk about what Landau's have proposed as a theory describing interacting fermionic system. Landau's Fermi liquid theory is a modification of the theory of free fermion. The modification is the Landau parameter, which is a set of function of two momenta, P and P prime, that modify the energy of a quasi-particle. So an energy, a quasi-particle with momentum P and located at the point X has an energy, which is a sum of the free energy of that particle and an energy that is linearly proportional to the deviation of the distribution function from the ground state distribution function. So this function F determines the influence. So here there is a prime sign that I missed, should be P prime, that excess of quasi-particle of momentum P prime influences the energy of the particle at point X. Then Landau proposed that the kinetic equation has to be modified. The modification basically is due to the fact is that now the energy of this particle, it has an X dependence, and then we have to put in here also the dependence of the energy or respect to X. And by the way, this V, I didn't put right down, this V is also the epsilon P over dP. And this epsilon P can be also a function of X. So minimal modification of the Liouville's theory for free particle, but one can derive this Landau Fermi liquid theory from, say, perturbation theory. And that was done in Abrikosov, Perkov, Jelashinsky. In particular, the two-point function that one gets by solving this kinetic equation give rise to all the known kinetic, mode of Fermi liquid, for example, zero sum would be a solution to this kinetic equation. Okay, so now Landau Fermi liquid theory, at least in this formulation, is not. It is not, strictly speaking, a field theory, though it has, it is very compelling to identify Fermi liquid theory with an effective field theory. Basically, the philosophy of Landau is very modern. It is a philosophy of low energy effective field theory. We don't need to know all the details of the microscopic dynamics to determine low energy correlation function. All we need to know are some parameters. Landau's called them the Landau's parameter, but in effective field theory, this would be called the Wilson coefficients of the coefficients of the effective Lagrangian. But on the other hand, the Landau Fermi liquid theory as formulated by Landau is not not a standard Lagrangian field theory based on action. And this feature, this feature of Landau Fermi liquid theory disallows a large toolbox of effective field theory. For example, one cannot, we don't know exactly how to do power counting, how to take into account correction to Landau Fermi liquid theory, how to formulate the loop correlations. As well, it doesn't allow a certain set of insight that we are used to, the insight of Wilsonian viewpoint of Landau Fermi of effective field theory. So this formulation of Landau Fermi liquid theory formulation of Landau Fermi liquid theory as a field theory would be useful. One of the reasons is that we want to understand something called the non-Fermi liquid, which one example of such a non-Fermi liquid is a 2 plus 1 dimensional fermions at finite density coupled to a gauge field. And to do power counting in this theory, it is still an art. We don't have the understanding of this behavior, the low energy behavior of non-Fermi liquid as a fixed point, say in a Wilsonian type fixed point in effective field theory, in some quantum field theory. I must say that there have been a lot of work, previous work, dealing with the exactly the same problem, how to formulate Landau Fermi liquid theory as an effective field theory. In the 1990s, many people, including Puchinsky, Shankar, tried to write down effective theory, tried to imagine an effective theory of the degrees of freedom near the Fermi surface, and write down an action similar to this one. This is from Puchinsky, Dassey lecture. In order to formulate such a theory, one needs to divide the Fermi surface into different batches. One of the annoying feature of these quantum field theories is that the Fermi surface doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't disappear when we do renormalization group and then try to zoom in into the low energy regime. Low energy in Fermi liquid doesn't correspond to low momenta. And so we have to, one of the approach is to divide the Fermi surface into different batches. But this work by Puchinsky and Shankar is very, is a groundbreaking work. It tells us how to understand scaling properties of Landau and BCS coupling and why these are the only important coupling. There is also another way to think about the problems that's based on approach called bosonization. In 1 plus 1 dimension, bosonization is a very well-developed tool. It's very rigorous. One can map a system of fermion into bosons. But this problem, this bosonization starts to have a lot of issues when we try to generalize it to higher dimension. Say in 2 dimensions, can think about a 2 dimension, the philosophy of bosonization in higher dimension is that one think about each ray in momentum space as a chiral fermion, a system of chiral fermion at some finite density, and then bosonize it into a chiral boson. So at each point on the Fermi sphere, we would have a separate chiral boson. So here, the chiral boson is a function of x and in 2 dimensions, the angle in momentum space theta. And one can write down certain field theory, try to get insight from physics and match the correlation function. For example, one can write down the quadratic action for the bosons in 2 dimensions like this one, and convince ourselves that one get the correct density correlation function. But this approach has several problems. So first, it's not clear how to write down interaction terms and what are the constraints that one have to impose. Another important problem is that we are here trying to think about the system as a system of boson at each value of theta. On the other hand, we know that if we put the system in an external field, electric or magnetic field, a quasi-particle that was originally at one point in theta can move to another point in momentum space, for example, by the Lorentz force, if there is a magnetic field. And that is make this approach pretty cumbersome. Actually, this was one of the source of insight that led Els, Thorngren, and Salthill to a notion they call ersatz Fermi liquid. And there is no time here to review their paper, but they emphasize the role of anomaly in Fermi liquid. The anomaly here basically is the anomalies that give rise to non-conservation of particle number at each point on the Fermi surface. So let me formulate the problem that we want to solve. Our problem in this talk is very modest. We want to reformulate Landau Fermi liquid theory as a field theory with an action S as a functional of some kind of field phi, so that the equation of motion delta S over delta phi equal to zero give us the Landau's kinetic equation. And we are going to use a method in mathematics called the method of Gower joint orbit to accomplish this task. So in the next few transparency, I'm going to present to you some mathematics, hopefully simple enough to grasp at least the part that is needed for our construction. So let us start by fixing our notation. So we can see the Lie group G and a Lie algebra that is lowercase cosec G. And elements of the algebra is denoted by uppercase F, and the exponents of that uppercase F is an element of the Lie group. Now we know from the theory of representation that for any Lie group, there is a joint representation. So the adjoint representation is defined by mapping, say, each of the elements of the algebra is a linear operator that map elements of the, this adjoint representation is realized on the Lie algebra itself. So element G would correspond to a linear map that maps an element F of the algebra to the commutator of this G with F. So sometimes the commutator I denote with a square bracket, sometimes with a curly bracket here. It's the same square bracket. And then for elements U in G, I can also denote, I can also introduce a joint representation by exponentiating this commutator. So basically, so now let me introduce something called the co-adjoint representation. It's very easy rather trivial to introduce. We introduce the dual space G star. The dual space basically is a space where if we take two elements, one from G star and the other is G, then we can define the scalar product between them. And the scalar product would be a real number, and the scalar product would have linear property. The co-adjoint representation is defined on G star. It's realized not in G, but in G star. And it's defined so that the scalar product is invariant under a joint and co-adjoint action of a group, of any group element on F, small f and big F. So is there any, are there any questions so far? No? Let me go to one more mathematical notion. It's called the notion of co-adjoint orbit. Defined this way. So let us take one element of the one vector in the dual space G star. The co-adjoint orbit O. Sorry, somehow I lost this. Just one second. The co-adjoint orbit is a set of all points in G star that is obtained from a given element G star by a co-adjoint group action. So I take all group element U, act on F0, and then find something called the co-adjoint orbit. So I take the F0 and then act on that all possible elements of U of the group G and find this trajectory of this F0, and that's called the co-adjoint orbit. So the co-adjoint orbit then is a lab coset. It's a coset of the our group G and the subgroup H that is stabilized by F0. The group H is a group of all elements of G which leave F0 unchanged. So anything H, any elements of H acting on F0 will give me F0. So let's go to one simple example. So SU2 group. SU2 group, we know that the SU2 algebra can be thought of as spanned by the Pauli matrices, tau1, tau2, and tau3. The duals, so the SU3 algebra is a three-dimensional space. The dual space is then also a three-dimensional space parameterized by F1, F2, and F3. And the scalar product between F, big F and small f can be defined as just a vector product of these two three-dimensional vectors. And so here, the co-adjoint action of the group on this vector f is just a SO3 rotation of the vector f. And then a co-adjoint orbit of a vector f would be a sphere. Even except when this vector f is zero, if we start from some f0 that is non-zero and we add elements of the SU2 group on that, we get a co-adjoint orbit, which is a sphere, two-dimensional sphere. So the co-adjoint orbit doesn't coincide with the dual space. It's just to think about that as a surface in the dual space. So one mathematical fact, one important mathematical theorem that is always presented in the theory of co-adjoint orbit is that there exists a symplectic form in co-adjoint orbit. So what is a symplectic form? The symplectic form is a two form that is anti-symmetric and the differential of that is zero. So it's a closed form. So I'm not going, maybe here I'm just mention how it is defined. So you have a co-adjoint orbit here, and we have a point F on the co-adjoint orbit. A two form is always a map from two vectors, tangent vector to a number. So we have two tangent vectors, so delta F1 and delta F2, tangent to this co-adjoint orbit. Then we have to put that into correspondence with the number. And this number is written here. It is the scalar product of this F, which is a covector, and the commutator of the two members of the algebra, F1 and F2, that correspond to the infinitesimal shift from F to F plus delta F1, F plus delta F2. And it's, one can show various properties of that, the symplectic form. It doesn't depend on what is the choice of, there is a certain ambiguity in choosing F1, F2, doesn't depend on the choice of that, and this form is closed. Okay, so I'm just here if you didn't completely get this, definition, we will return to it a bit later in a more concrete example. Any questions so far?
Can I ask one? So just to be a little bit more concrete, so if I go back to the SU2 example, sphere, what does this two form become?
It is just the area form on the sphere. You can see that here. So suppose I take a Q0 along the Z direction. So let me put this, it's a Z direction. So then if you use this formula, then this two form basically a form which is proportional to the area. It's an area form. This Kirillov Kostan Suryo symplectic form, I read that it's important for people doing the theory of representation of the Kirillov group, but I don't know detail why the mathematicians are so interested in that. Okay, so in our theory of the Fermi lipid channel, that what is important is the group that we are going to that is going to be useful for us is a group of canonical transformations. So that group G, that for which we will build the coadjoint orbit, is the group of canonical transformation. Canonical transformation can be parameterized. So here, the canonical transformation acts in phase space. So here I have some phase space of a single particle parameterized by x and p. And an infinitesimal canonical transformation would map x to x prime and y to p to p prime like this. Basically, it's like a Hamiltonian evolution where the Hamiltonian is this function f. You can see that it preserves the Poisson bracket. And two of these canonical transformation do not commute, and the commutator of the two canonical transformation, infinitesimal transformation with parameter f and g, is another canonical transformation with the parameter equal to the Poisson bracket between f and g. So there is a group of canonical transformations, and we can that can be obtained by exponentiating the Lie algebra of canonical transformation. So the Lie group is a group of finite now canonical transformation e to the f. Okay, so now the Lie algebra can be parameterized by function f, x and p. Then we can now define the dual space. This dual space is also parameterized by function of x and p. Dual space is a linear space of the function of f and p. And the scalar product can be thought of as integral of f times capital F over the phase space. Now this seems to be quite trivial mathematics, but in physics, we can assign certain interpretation for each of these objects here. This F, the elements of the Lie algebra, we're going to think about that as an observable. F is an observable. So for example, if we have an F that is equal to, say, P squared over 2M, so that F corresponds to the kinetic energy of fermions. Of our fermions. While the small f will be interpreted as something characterizing the state of our system. Small f is what we would call the distribution function. And the scalar product of small f and big f is the average, the expectation value of the observable f in the state f, small f. Right, so this integral here is nothing but just if we take this big F to be the P squared over 2M, this is the total energy, kinetic energy of a system where the occupation number is given by small f. In quantum mechanics, this would be equivalent to what usually we would write as trace of F, rho, usually we call that rho, the density matrix with F. So distribution, the dual space is the space of the would be the state characterized, the vector in dual space is the state of our system. Okay, so now we can define the adjoint and co-adjoint action of our of a group element onto the system. So if we have a group elements u, so here I make a typo, should be exponent of g, exponent of g, then acting that exponent of g on f can be done explicitly by just computing this Poisson bracket. So here this is now a Poisson bracket. So we can do all calculation explicitly in perturbation theory of g. So the adjoint and co-adjoint action, basically the formula for these are the same in our system, in our for our group. But it's still useful to distinguish them since one refer to state, the other refer to observables. So now what is the co-adjoint orbit? We choose now as F0, the ground state of our fermionic system, a state where the occupation number is one inside a round Fermi surface with Fermi momentum Pf, F equal to one here and F equal to zero here. And we act on that distribution function, finite canonical transformation. Right? And canonical transformation are like Hamiltonian evolutions. And so what we know is that the Fermi surface, the occupation number would still be either one or zero. The co-adjoint orbit would map this to some, the co-adjoint orbit can be thought of as space of different type shape of Fermi surface. The shape can also vary in space. So we can access state with the sharp Fermi surface with the same total number of particles by canonical transformation. And so the low energy state of a fermionic system is then the co-adjoint orbit, is just a co-adjoint orbit. The evolution of our system occurs on the co-adjoint orbit, and now our task is to parameterize the co-adjoint orbit and write down an action for the system. Okay, to parameterize the co-adjoint orbit, what we have to do.
Yeah. Just to make sure, in the previous slide, ground state, this one. So this is the theta function. Should I think of this as parameterizing the Fermi surface of the quasi-particle of the original fermion?
Of course, these are quasi-particles.
Yeah, then this is some fictitious UV completion of my knowledge theory.
No, it's not a fictitious. It's a real, the Fermi surface is real, is a well-defined thing, yeah? And we just say F equals to one or F equals to zero. We don't care what happened here, actually. All we care is that it's just something that is fueled. It's okay. The fact that the Landau Fermi liquid theory, nothing depends on what is very deep inside the Fermi surface.
Uh-huh, so being a theta function is not that important?
Theta function is not important. It's everything will be eventually delta function. You see all the physically important quantities is determined by derivative of that F. As you can see, for example, here, for example, if I'm now trying to see how the we will work in perturbation theory in we would do infinitesimal canonical transformation. So canonical transformation are parameterized by a function of phase space. So this phi here is a function of x and p, right? Now acting using the formula that I sketched before, acting that on F0, you find that the distribution function of the new state is equal to this theta function plus a delta function. So what is a theta function plus a delta function? A theta function is round Fermi surface plus a delta function. Delta function is a derivative of the theta function. So actually what is happening here is that we deform the Fermi surface to a new shape. And what is staying here is how much that Fermi surface has moved in momentum space. Okay. Check it this way. And so we by doing this, we parameterize the shape of the Fermi surface by a function. It's phi. my new function phi. But in fact, it's actually redundant because remember, our co-adjoint orbit is not the space co-adjoint orbit is not G, but the coset G over H, where H is the group where F0 is a stabilizer. And it turned out that we can use this. So there is certain gauge redundancy in defining this phi, which can be used to fix gauge in phi. And one of the possible gauge turned out to be that this phi function is not a function of x and p, but a function of x and the direction of p only, not the absolute value of p, but only the angle theta where p, which is the angle of this p in momentum space. So here we find that the co-adjoint orbit can be parameterized by a function phi, which is a function of x and the angle.
So is the topology of Fermi surface preserved under in this co-adjoint orbit?
Yeah, that's the I assume here that I only Fermi surface with a spherical with the same topology f zero. Otherwise, I have to start from a different f zero.
So
I won't be able to include in the same theory Fermi surface with different topology. You have to have different sectors of the theory. But here, I'm going to work just in the vicinity of around Fermi surface.
So whether topology changes or not also depends on the choice of canonical transformation?
For smooth canonical transformation, I think it won't change. Or a canonical transformation that is smooth in phase space, then and the topology, I don't think it changed. Yeah, okay, so this co-adjoint orbit is nice because now you see.
Can I ask one more question? I guess here you are talking about spherical Fermi surface. I guess if you want to change it to other shape, that's not too hard.
If it is the same topology at the sphere, then the co-adjoint orbit would be identical to that of a sphere. In fact, I think if you fix the total volume, that is a volume integrated over a whole space, then all the canonical transformation can move from one shape to another shape.
Mm-hmm. But the physical context I have in mind is Lipschitz transition where we have some Van Hoff singularity such that the topology of the Fermi surface is about to change. In that case, at Lipschitz transition point, can we generalize it to that case?
I'm not sure. I think it probably requires some extension of what I'm going to talk about with probably some extension. We haven't worked on that yet.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
So maybe one question. So here, if momentum space is compact, so if you allow some periodic function in
mm-hmm.
your canonical transformation, I wonder mm-hmm. whether even smooth canonical transformation can induce change in topology.
I'm not sure. I think it's probably no, but I haven't thought about that.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So now let us write down the action for this. So here is the action. I claim this is the action that this is very simple action that one can write down. The non-trivial part of that is this first term. So the first term basically is each point, and you know, so here we have here in the notation, I have a co-adjoint orbit, there is a F0, And HF is obtained by F0 by acting on it elements of the group canonical transformation for U. And the first term is this time first, evolved first time derivative over U. It's actually non-trivial to check that this doesn't depend on the choice of U. There is an ambiguity. For each F, there is various U that lead to the same F, but it doesn't change the first term or change it by a total time derivative. And the second term is just the Hamiltonian. Hamiltonian is a functional on this co-adjoint orbit. So the first term actually is related to what we defined previously as the Kirillov-Kostad-Suryov form. It's can be written in a Westumina-Witten form by introducing an extra coordinate S, and this first term is just the integral of these two form over T and S. For free fermions, this term is just the energy of the fermions, with F being the occupation number of this free fermion system. So this is, you can think about that, it's just integral over the xdp of epsilon p times distribution function px. Now the first term is non-trivial. It is basically the very phase that one obtains when we think about a adiabatic change of a fermionic system where the shape of the Fermi surface changes. We have a fermionic a wave function corresponding to some Fermi surface. I can imagine deforming that Fermi surface and asking myself, what is the very phase that one gets, and that the first term is that very phase. Okay, so now one can do calculations. So for example, we can expand this Lagrangian, this action to quadratic order over phi, and what one find is just a action of chiral bosons, one chiral boson per angle. So this is a formula in two dimension, two plus one dimension. Each value of theta, there is a chiral boson, theta, phi of x and theta. And this is the action of this chiral boson. The chiral boson moves in the direction n of theta, which is the unit vector pointing in the theta direction. Okay, so, and we know also how the density operator relate to this chiral boson phi, and from that we can compute, for example, density operator. So in free fermion theory, we can reproduce the calculation of this loop graph as a tree-level diagram in the bosonic theory. These loop diagrams give us some result which is the same as this tree-level diagram in the low energy limit. So in two dimension, here is the formula. But non-trivially, one can even go to higher non-linear response. Non-linear response has a certain rigidity in our theory. These non-linear terms come from by expanding, for example, the Westumina-Witten term accurately to third order in terms of the field. And there is a rule, this Poisson bracket completely determine everything that one gets from here. And for free fermion theory, one can also compute what would be the correction, cubic correction. The Lagrangian for bosonic theory looks like these. These are rather non-trivial because you see the boson now couple to each other. Boson with different theta now start to talk with each other by the presence of these terms in the Lagrangian derivative with respect to theta. And one can check that this loop graph in free fermion theory is identical to the results that one gets if one do the calculation in our bosonic theory with taking into account two effects. First of all, there is a vertex of interaction, three boson vertex. And secondly, our density contains also term proportions to rho squared. adding these two diagrams together, both three, we get the result that coincide with the free fermion theory. And more interestingly, this fermionic calculation involve cancellation between two different diagrams, the two different permutations of these external vertices. And this cancellation is automatic in the bosonic theory. We don't have actually cancellation. Each of these terms are of the correct order. And that also appear in higher order correlation function, 4-point function, etc., 5-point function, etc. There are more and more cancellation that is more and more non-trivial in the fermionic calculation, but in the bosonic theory, we always have tree diagram with the trivial correct power counting. Okay, so now let me.
Yeah. So back to the maybe the previous slide. So if I'm naive, if I just do the usual old bosonization, I may naively write down many possible symmetry allowed interactions.
Mm-hmm.
And what you are saying here is saying that only a specific combination is actually legal?
Yeah, I think the what we understand here is that, so for example, this term, the Weissmuller-Wittgenstein term is pretty rigid. They are rigidly fixed by the symplectic structure in the theory. The Hamiltonian has to be a function not of a phi, but a function of f. And so remember this, there is a gauge invariance. Basically, if you take e to the phi times e to the phi alpha, where this is elements of the group H, which is stabilized by F0, then the Hamiltonian should not change. So this condition is quite non-trivial in this case. There is still residual gauge run. After we fix the gauge, there is certain residual gauge invariance that still has to be satisfied.
I see. So simply imposing phi to only depend on theta does not completely fix the gauge for you.
It doesn't. Yeah. Fully. Yeah. I think there is some. Actually, that's how we started. We tried to impose certain condition, and got very confused. One point: what could be the, what could be, for example, why here, why it's a quadratic order? We cannot write something that involves theta derivative of phi, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and why a cubic order? This term is allowed. Yeah, and I think we have a way to think about this now.
I see. Thanks.
One more question.
Yeah.
Sorry. In this language, what's the single fermionic operator?
There is no single fermionic operator yet in our theory. So we are not sure how to and whether it's possible to include single fermion operators in the theory. The good news is that if you are interested only in bosonic correlation functions like rho-rho or density-density or current-current correlation function, then we don't have to deal with the fermion.
But we may be interested in the spectral function in the RPAS, then we need to know the fermion-fermion correlation function.
Let me speculate about that a little closer to the end of the talk,
uh-huh.
Which is the end quite near now. So I want to give you,
Just want to make sure in this theory, what's the, you said you will do some expansion. Is the expansion parameter just the number of loops, or is there another, is something like the interaction strength encoded in the epsilon?
Included in
what's the you said you will do some perturbation calculation. What's the perturbative mm-hmm. parameter?
So here it is the power of phi. So here basically if we if we want to compute, for example, three-point function, we will have to expand this this Lagrangian to cubic order in phi. So include this term.
Does it come with some dimensionless coupling constant? A small
it comes with a natural coupling constant. It comes with a natural coupling constant. This thing has to have some properties that it always comes with certain derivatives. So for example, to quadratic order here, this phi always have to appear with derivatives. So this derivative can be derivative of a theta in the cubic case. So to all order, there is a certain power of one over pf. That one
always
comes out.
Thank you.
Question. So one more question about this slide. So the phi field should depend on the coordinates and the direction in the momentum space, right?
Yeah.
So should I think about it as some compact boson with some radius?
That I'm not sure. In one dimension, of course, we have one plus one dimension, we have this intuition. But this intuition breaks down in two. In one plus one dimension, the quantization of charge gives rise to the periodicity of phi. Here we are really talking about particle moving in the direction of theta. Here, I don't think there is a quantization of the number of particle moving along the direction of theta.
So what is the generator of the global charge conservation in this theory?
This the total charge. Yeah, the total charge can be written down. Again, it's something like this operator, integrated over x as well. Okay, integrated over x. Both x and theta, then this would be a charge. Yeah, and phi, the commutator at phi and phi come from this phi dot grad phi. So it's like commutator is the same as that of at this level, it's the same as chiral boson.
Oh, yeah. I see. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so I can I ask for maybe 5 more minutes? Probably less.
I'm not going to cut you off, so go ahead.
Okay, so So maybe I describe a few possible extension of this theory. So back to canonical transformation. Actually, one way to understand this canonical transformation, the group of canonical transformation, or the algebra of canonical transformation as the as an algebra of bifermion operator. So here I'm writing down this Psi-Decker operator, anti-symmetrized, and so that's written this way. This operator, one can see, form a closed algebra because Psi-Decker commute to just delta function. So bifermion operator form an algebra by itself. One can show that in a long wavelength limit, this algebra is identical to the algebra of canonical transformations. And suggests to us several extensions of this theory. So for example, we can try to include spin in the picture, spinful Fermi surface. This we will have a different Lie algebra and different Lie group. The algebra is spanned by operator where we make use of the spin index to construct bifermion operator. And in the BCS theory, in addition to the operator Psi-Decker, we can include operator Psi-Decker, or Psi-Psi operator. And so this would be another algebra larger than the usual algebra of canonical transformation, but we can apply exactly the same. It seems that there is no obstacle for us to apply the same formalism to construct an effective theory of the BCS, of a BCS Fermi liquid in as a theory of co-adjoint orbit. Maybe even if we include the operator psi of x, psi of dagger of y, we can get a sort of a graded Lie algebra and try to work with these graded Lie algebra to include in the theory now also single fermion operator. So that is a very vague thought that we haven't pursued that. Okay, so let me conclude. The method of co-adjoint orbit provides a natural way to write down a bosonic effective field theory of a Fermi liquid. It reproduces not only the linear, but on the nonlinear Fermi liquid responses in a rather mathematically, rather rigid framework where we have certain constraints on the form of the effective field theory. Would be interesting to explore what this approach gives to the study of non-Fermi liquid. Right now, what we can see is that, at least, is that it gives us an approach in which a correlation function, which in the fermionic theory, a one-loop diagram, involved a lot of cancellation, become natural. But we think that this might be there might be more applications of this theory. Thank you very much for your attention.
So can you see Fermi liquid state as a fixed point of this theory?
Fixed point in the sense that you see
some under some coarse grain
power counting.
Yeah, for example.
Yeah, we are still we haven't looked that. I think it's probably possible to see it and possible to see the logarithm in BCS theory also.
Okay. And another question is if we are to do some path integration for this collective variables. Mm-hmm. So here I guess phi field is the dynamical variable that one needs to do path integration over, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And does the, I don't know, is there some, well, how do we define the measure for those collective modes? Is there a way to, I guess yeah. There are infinitely many ways for the Fermi surface to be deformed, right? And
yeah.
Is there a canonical way of selecting independent modes out of those?
No, but this co-adjoint orbit method basically is, in some sense, the classical version of a certain coherent state. Certain coherent state. So this F0, which we think of as a state of a round Fermi surface, we can think about that as just some quantum state psi zero. And then this operator, all the operator of the U that belong to the group of canonical transformation, these can be identified with a unitary operator. So it's just exponents of some function x and p and xy psi x psi dec of y. So we can think about this co-adjoint orbit. I think this is my expectation of what's going to happen. It's not that what that I know all the details. I think this co-adjoint orbit Each point the joint orbit is going to correspond to a coherent state. And one can define the path integral using this coherent state.
Mm-hmm. And usually these coherent states are overcomplete, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I expect the same thing would happen here as well. And this overcompleteness condition will give us the measure of integral. Let me also mention something I haven't mentioned in this talk. So this talk was prepared last minute, and a lot of references are omitted. The method of co-adjoint orbit has been applied to various other contexts, quantum Hall effect, etc. And in the Fermi system, there was a paper by Krishenko a long time ago, right? I think we managed to basically finish what Krishenko was set out to do, but did not complete.
I have a question related to the previous compact boson question. So, do we know about what is this group of canonical transformation? I understand that it's an infinite dimensional group. But do we know the topology of it so that the phi can be compact or something like that?
Doesn't seem to be, no, it's not it's an infinite dimensional non-compact Lie group from what I can say in more than one dimension. As I was trying to say here, the total charge involves integral over theta, and so it doesn't integral over theta, so it doesn't seems natural for me that this phi should be compact. Maybe some in some sense integral of phi over theta or something, but I don't have a good understanding of what the quantization of charge corresponds to this bosonic formulation.
I see, thank you. And another question is that can you comment on you mentioned that at the beginning that it is hard to do the Wilsonian picture in the original Landau Fermi liquid. Can you comment on how can you do Wilsonian RG formalism in your new approach?
This is still something that that we hope to do. We want to understand. So since now it's a field theory, right? It's a field theory with a rigid structure. It seems that there is a we don't have to worry about certain cancellations that is not natural. We can just try to figure out if we do Wilsonian renormalization group, how should we scale x, how would we scale time and theta. But the angle, the scaling of theta is still some there is probably very most likely subtlety that we still have to work out. But in some regimes, I assume that we just need to work out how X and theta scale.
Thank you very much.
Question. So how can I see the Barry phase of a quasi-particle moving on the Fermi surface in this formalism?
So here, so one thing that the Barry curvature. So the Barry curvature can be seemingly it's possible to include the effect of Barry curvature in in our group structure. Basically, we started with the group of canonical transformation. We preserved the Poisson bracket, the usual Poisson bracket, x and p equals to 1. But there is a very curvature we can think about, a different type of Poisson bracket, in xn, xi, and xj do not commute, and j, for example. So we have a different, seems that we have to work with a different algebra, a different group, xi and pj will be, say, delta ij, maybe plus or not. And I think the whole approach can be have to be modified. But it's possible.
Oh, so okay. So in current discussion, you've not included the Barry curvature effect on the Fermi surface.
The Barry curvature in momentum. You mean the Barry curvature in momentum space?
Right? Yeah.
In momentum space, it Barry curvature. We didn't include it there. I think this might be this is a straightforward way to generalize the formalism.
Thank you.
From this new formalism, can we get more understanding of the anomaly of Fermi nucleus?
Yes. The anomaly in 1+1 dimension. So for example, it's directly followed. So we have a section in our paper about how to understand anomaly. It turns out that we need to first couple. We can think about anomalies this way. We can couple the theory to a gauge field. But since our group is a group of canonical transformation, this gauge field actually is a non-abelian gauge field. We can do maximal gauging, that is, gauge all the symmetry. In our case, the gauge potential can be introduced to be a function of x and p, and carries both x and p indices. Now, this gauge thing can be done without any anomalies. There's no obstruction to do this gauging. There is no anomaly here. No anomaly. Anomaly appears when we expand our theory around the Fermi surface state, Fermi liquid state. So for example, we take a fermionic system in one dimension with the Fermi line, Fermi C, like this, from PF to minus PF. Expanding around this ground state, we have the anomalies that correspond to the non-conservation of particle number around this point. But it is, in our approach, it is an effect that comes out from linearization. It's not there in our theory in the beginning. And the same thing happened also in higher dimensions. That non-conservation of particle number that move in point in different point angle in Fermi surface, which satisfies certain equation that looks like the equation of anomaly, comes out from linearization, from certain expansion of a more broader theory, of a larger theory with no anomaly.
I see. So the anomaly from the linearized mode will be canceled by the non-linearized mode. That's the statement.
I forget the details, but I think there is in the action there are terms with different when we expand the action in terms of phi, there is linear in phi term, quadratic in phi, cubic in phi.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm not mistaken, the linear in phi term is also important to get these features. Write down equation from the quadratic terms. There is a source that comes from the linear term. The source looks like a anomaly. My memory might be.
Just to make sure, a very maybe a very simple point. I guess this approach only applies to Fermi surface, but not Bose surface, is it that?
I don't know Bose surface at all. I have no...
The difference is for Fermi surface, that's the concept of inside and outside of Fermi surface. So the both are chiral around Fermi surface. For both surface, there's no inside outside. And it's non-chiral everywhere. I'm asking because it seems in the approach it's important that you have some F equal to one and F equal to zero as the reference point.
Right. But one can also ask if it can be replaced by F equal to half and F equal minus a half, and then nothing would change. And there's probably some kind of it's one and zero is some, unless one think about the question like a total number of particles, then whether it's one or zero would be important. But in all two-point function, et cetera, what's important is not whether it's one or zero at the jump. So I'm not sure if in the if in the bosonic case there is something, there's a theory which doesn't need to know just the curve, but not the the absolute value of F from a two
square. I thought for the bosonic cases, usually the F inside and outside are the same. There's no concept of a sharp jump of F. But that's my understanding.
Right. Yeah. So maybe the Hamiltonian. Maybe. Yeah. I'm not. I don't know much about the. I don't know much about the bosonic system to say something concrete. But it looks like to me that this, at least the parameterization of the degree of freedom might still be applicable the construction or the construction of the presumed Wigton term. It's not applicable there, but maybe just have to identify the mode might still work there.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Yeah.
Aaron?
Thank you. Thanks for a very, very, very interesting talk. I had a very basic question. How does one extract the quasi-particle residue capital Z from this theory, or if it is at all possible?
Well, if we limit ourselves to the original formulation, formulation of this theory without any extension, just with operator the canonical transformation, there is no single fermions in this theory, so there's no. One can ask, for example, if that single fermion actually is a real object for a Fermi surface coupled to U1 gauge field, for example. And I hesitate myself about this. But in principle, that's what I'm trying to say here. If one really wants fermions, one can try to include the single fermion operator, psi x pi deca y. In addition to the psi decal x phi y, so that this will form a graded algebra, Lie algebra, and maybe there is a way to formulate the coadjoint Northwick method.
I think that's where I'm a bit confused. So suppose I don't define single fermion operator. So let me only define densities. Let's say psi decal x, psi y. Even then, we know how to extract if psi is a bare electron creation operator, just looking at the momentum distribution of n of k, which is only bilinear, does not require knowing the full Green function, just c dagger k, ck expectation value as a function of k gives me the capital Z. So that doesn't even require defining single fermion creation operator, it only requires defining densities of the bare fermion, not of quasi particles. So I was wondering.
So this one is not a free fermion operator. In the Fermi liquid theory, what I'm saying is that the structure of Fermi liquid theory, the notion of Fermi surface, etc., these are really quasi-particle concepts. And the notion of this periphase when the Fermi surface moves in space a claim that is not that 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 has to be in order to compute it. We have to think about a Fermi surface of a quasi particle, this Berry phase. Let me make a statement. Maybe that's a controversial statement. The Berry phase, because I haven't, it seems non-trivial to me, that the Berry phase, when I deform the Fermi surface of a free fermion, is equal to the Berry phase when I deform the Fermi surface of non-interacting fermion, but this Fermi surface has to be defined as a Fermi surface of quasi-particle. Because the structure of the fermion, the Landau Fermi criteria dictates that Berry phase.
I see.
So this psi is, maybe there is a way to think about this operator in a theory with fermion coupled to the gauge field by thinking about a Wilson line connecting them. But that's,
And maybe can I ask one more question? There's this old paper by David Morse and Senthil where they have some, I mean, they were thinking of again Fermi liquid as a bunch of chiral bosons at, like at each point. And there they were trying to, my understanding was that in that paper, they are really thinking of that each chiral boson is, if I understood correctly, was a compact object, that it has a radius, and then they try to find vortices in it and try to condense vortices to get some, I don't know, phase transition and so on. Is it fair to say that here, since you mentioned it's not a compact, I mean, it's not a compact variable, your phi, so then there's no obvious relation to that work, or I'm trying to just understand the connection to this, this work by Morse and Senthil, where they kind of try to define vortices in this object. You can't probably define vortex in your phi if it's not a compact object.
No, I can, well, I could say that right now I cannot. Right now I cannot. Yeah. But yeah.
Okay.
Maybe. Yeah. I don't understand how to, because eventually all these number of particles along the theta direction, they are not are conserved by themselves, and they are not even, I don't think they are even quantized as integer at each value of theta, just the integral over all theta give us something that is quantized. Yeah, so there might be some kind of one single periodicity condition. I'm very confused right now, but for each value of theta, each phi at each theta is compact seems unreal, seems too much for me.
And does this approach relate to any kind of other bosonization people talk about? For example, we know various dualities for relativistic systems, where fermion boson dualities, which look completely different. They're here, both sides have sort of Fermi surface in the sense that, I mean, I was wondering if you consider a relativistic version of this where, but that I mean, you take the chemical potential, let's consider as say, try to apply this to Dirac fermions rather than, does it map to something maybe known in some other way using some, for example, the various dualities between Dirac fermions coupled to gauge fields and so on? Is there, this is a very random question. I don't know, maybe.
No, it's not, we don't have, in particular, for example, in this approach, there's not much difference between non-relativistic and relativistic fermion. The only thing that we change is that how this epsilon depends on P. p squared over 2m or absolute value of p. That's it. When there is an interaction, then we can ask, for example, how interaction, what kind of condition that Lorentz invariants, for example, or Galilean invariants impose onto our theory. And that we can figure out just by requiring that the action should be invariant under certain Lorentz or Galilean transformation.
Mm-hmm.
But the Fermi surface itself doesn't seem to care whether.
But that implies that you have a duality between, let's say, when you consider Dirac fermion, then you don't have really any angular variable theta. You just have you're shrinking the whole thing to zero. So is the claim that you have some duality between a Dirac fermion and some theory of only bosons which live only at zero momentum?
I think this approach works only for when you have a finite Fermi surface.
Okay.
Because then if this existence of Fermi surface allows us to identify mode, low energy mode as there is a bosonic low energy mode as deformation of the shape of the Fermi surface. And then everything is then goes to co-adjoint orbit, etc. If the Fermi surface shrinks to a point, then the identification of degrees of freedom has have to be done differently.
Mm-hmm.
I have a different question. So is it possible to study things like 2KF response in this formulation?
In principle, one should be able to reproduce that. In particular, I think that the full, it might be complicated because of the following. So 2KF means we have to give up finite momentum, zero momentum, low momentum limit. So the correspondence between the algebra of this by fermion operate, this algebra is the algebra of canonical transformation only in the long wavelength limit. So otherwise, this algebra would have the form of some Moyal algebra with the commutation relation, there is some sine function. But presumably, if we carefully do the calculation there, we should be able to get the 2KF, show the 2KF singularity.
I see.
Because the 2KF singularity appear in three fermions, and we should be able to map this free fermion theory to a bosonic theory.
Actually, okay, this may be solid state 101 type of question, but can one possibly see anything like 2KF in transport equation?
Transport, no. Transport like
right, that assumes small q, yeah.
Yeah, this assumes small q.
Yeah, okay. Okay.
So I'm trying to understand the set of low energy states of the full fermionic system that are captured by this bosonic variable. So in the full fermionic system, one can imagine creating like a low energy excitation by not just change of the shape, but creating little droplet of particles above the Fermi surface. I mean, right? Not immediately. It's not wave. It's like little droplets of particle and hole created away from the Fermi surface, not too far. And strictly speaking, those excitations have different topology. So is there a sense in which those are not important?
So if you compute, for example, density correlation function, current correlation function,
right.
One can always formulate this problem using the bosonic variables that is written here. We check that there's nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
In the kinetic equation that correspond to saying that if you have small electromagnetic fields that deform the Fermi surface just a little bit, and that doesn't, maybe when the electromagnetic field is large, then it can take one, the can shred a piece of the Fermi surface and make it disconnected. That I'm not sure whether, I mean, yeah, not sure if it's possible. It requires certain non-linear. I don't think it appeared to any order in observation theory.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, any other question? Okay, if not, let's thank Song again. Yeah, thanks Song for this.
Thank you.
Wonderful.
Yeah.